5 hour, what's universal time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Iraqi special forces have battled their way into Mosul city limits, seizing control of state television facilities Tuesday. Lieutenant General Talib Shagati called the seizure significant and good news for the people of Mosul. The sign, he said, the real liberation is underway. The Iraqi offensive has captured surrounding villages and approaching the city from different directions to cut off escape routes by its Islamic State defenders. U.S. coalition spokesman Colonel John Dorian said what's unfolding is an Iraqi plan, the largest military operation of its kind since 2003.
The Iraqis have been working on this for some time. We've been there with them planning this. We've been providing our logistical support. We've got advice and assistance. We've been training the Iraqi security forces, so we've trained more than 54,000 forces, many of whom are participating in this battle.
He said IS fighters will be killed if they stand and fight. Meanwhile, UN human rights spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani said Tuesday, it appears IS defenders are prepared to use civilians as human shields.
What we have observed is a pattern that ISIL is taking people closer and closer to Mosul City. Initially, they had moved a lot of people into Hammam al-Alil, and then they started moving people from Hammam al-Alil closer to Mosul City.
U.S. anti-terror special envoy Brett McGurk voiced optimism about the operation, but he also called for patience, cautioning retaking Mosul will take time. Voters in Ivory Coast appear to have overwhelmingly approved a new constitution following a weekend referendum, despite calls for an opposition boycott. President Alassane Ouattara said the document will bring greater stability and help the country turn a page on a decade of conflict. It scraps the requirement that the parents of presidential candidates both be Ivorian, creates the post of vice president and a Senate. This is VOA News. Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump rallied supporters Tuesday in states seen as crucial in the final week before the U.S. November 8th election. Clinton made three campaign stops in Florida and spoke about what's at stake in the election.
Because honestly, I believe this may be the most important election of our lifetimes. Yeah. 1 week from today, we will be choosing our next president and commander-in-chief.
Trump campaigned in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. He was joined by his running mate, Governor Mike Pence, who promised health care reform to replace what's widely viewed as President Obama's signature domestic achievement, known as Obamacare, where millions currently face skyrocketing costs.
With Hillary Clinton, we'll get more of the same from the last 7.5 years. More taxes, more spending, more regulation, and more Obamacare.
National public opinion surveys show a tightening race in the closing days of the campaign. Earthquake aftershocks again hit the central regions of Italy, where thousands were left homeless by a 6.6 magnitude tremor Sunday. The aftershocks were recorded by seismologists at the rate of several per hour. The opposition in Venezuela Tuesday welcomed the government's decision to release three jailed activists and postponed its order for President Nicolas Maduro to appear to answer questions before the opposition-controlled National Assembly. The Assembly's president, Henry Ramos Alep, said this doesn't mean the opposition is going to wait 6 months to see what happens. He vowed it would walk away from Vatican-mediated talks if its demands are not met. Those demands include restarting a recall referendum to remove Mr. Maduro from office. Moroccan authorities say they have arrested 11 people and charged them with involuntary manslaughter in the controversial death of a street vendor that sparked days of protests. Mohsin Fikri, killed Friday as he tried to sell unlawful swordfish, he was crushed to death inside a garbage truck. Among the suspects are two security agents. At least 18 people, including women and children, were killed Tuesday in violence in Niger between cattle herders and farmers. The clashes erupted in the southern village Bangui near Nigeria after the livestock of ethnic Fulani herdsmen damaged a farmer's field. In Hanoi, a fire broke out at a karaoke lounge in the Vietnamese capital Tuesday, killing at least 13 people. Wednesday, the prime minister called for an investigation. The blaze began at lunchtime and quickly consumed the lounge and three adjacent houses. South Korean President Park Geun-hye, facing dwindling public support, replaced her prime minister and two other top cabinet officials Wednesday amid allegations she allowed a close friend who holds no official title to meddle in affairs of state. Choi Soon-sil allegedly made cabinet appointments, drafted speeches, and was given access to classified information. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An independent investigation says UN troops failed to protect civilians during last July's violence in Juba.
The investigation, headed by retired Dutch General Patrick Kamert, found that a lack of leadership on the part of key senior mission personnel culminated in a chaotic and ineffective response to the violence.
Las Vegas, Margaret Bashir at the United Nations. A bishop accused the South Sudan Army of killing civilians on the Juba Ye Road. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni Tuesday ordered the closure of Makerere University. DRC opposition Tuesday buried its members killed in the recent arrest. And Ivory Coast voters approve a new constitution.
Taux de participation 42.42%. Pour le oui, 2,480,000.
Bakayoko says the turnout was 42%, with 93% in favor.
Las Vegas, Emily Yelp in Abidjan, and popular messaging apps are failing to protect users' privacy. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's Africa's Post Roundup and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An independent investigation into July's deadly clashes in South Sudan's capital has concluded that UN military and mission personnel failed to protect civilians and aid workers. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir reports the mission's force commander is set to be replaced.
The investigation, headed by retired Dutch General Patrick Kamert, found that a lack of leadership on the part of key senior mission personnel culminated in a chaotic and ineffective response to the violence. The fighting between government soldiers supporting President Salva Kiir and troops loyal to opposition leader Riek Machar erupted July 8th near the presidential palace. More than 300 people were killed, and the fighting led to attacks, killings, rapes, looting, and other atrocities on the local population and foreign aid workers. Peacekeepers from China and Nepal were singled out for their poor performance during the episode. UN peacekeepers were also generally criticized for having a risk-averse posture not suited to protecting civilians from sexual violence and other attacks, and for not regularly patrolling outside their perimeter at night. UN spokesman Stéphane Dujarric told reporters Tuesday that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has asked for the force commander to be immediately replaced. He added that the UN chief is deeply distressed by these findings and will implement the investigators' recommendations. Those include that the UN further investigate peacekeeper shortcomings and hold the relevant actors accountable for their failures to protect. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A South Sudanese church leader says South Sudan Army murdered dozens of civilians on the Juba Ye Road on Tuesday. Bishop Paul Yugushu of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan in Sudan says the army was on a rescue mission to help stranded passengers after their vehicle was burned by unknown gunmen at Kulipapa village. But Bishop Yugushu says instead of helping, the army turned their anger at the civilians and killed men and women.
This is not a shooting, but it's actually a massacre where SPLA soldiers besiege a village called Korjik Bungu, 27 miles from Juba, along Juba Ye Road, and they kill 13 civilian women and men. And this happened yesterday early in the morning.
Do you know why the South Sudan Army decided to shoot villagers, or rather civilians, in this village?
We were told that there was an ambush in a village called Kulipapa, a far distance from Korjik Bungu. And then following that thing, the news went to Juba. And this is where the SPLA soldiers did that. Exactly. It's a retaliation for what had happened on Juba Ye Road. And again, it is confirming what the Minister of Information, Honorable Makui, said sometimes back, that the villagers should not protect the rebels. And if anything happened, the soldiers will not compromise. They will come and kill the villagers. This is just a confirmation of exactly what the minister has said. And the minister is responsible for exactly for what he has said. This is a clear indication that our government is supporting this atrocity.
Who ambushed this vehicle at Kulipapa?
We We don't know who ambushed, but indeed a vehicle has been ambushed. Four people were taken, and later three were released, and the car was burned. That's an incident that happened in Kulipapa, and we don't know exactly who ambushed this vehicle. And so that is the anger and the retaliation by the SPL. Of course, they are not happy with what had happened, and they paid on the villagers. We would like to strongly condemn this brutal act in the strongest term, and I call on the security entities, the government, to bring to justice those behind this crime.
We've heard statements like this before from you, the church leaders, from the international community, that the government of South Sudan should bring to book those who commit atrocities. Have you seen the government actually bringing their own to book when they commit crime?
Of course, no, but that will not stop us from saying that the culprits should be brought to books. It will not stop us. We'll continue to say it so. And if they don't bring, of course, they are responsible and God is witness.
And when were you last in Juba?
Last week.
Tell us a little bit about how life is in Juba. We are hearing very different kind of stories. The government is saying everything is okay, people are living peacefully, and there's no problem. But the common citizens are saying life is very difficult, that it's not easy to put food on the table. Could you tell us what your Christians are telling you?
Of course, I speak on behalf of Christians. That's my voice, and that's my spiritual authority. It depends on who you are, where you're working. People live at the state of fear. That is true. People don't know exactly what will happen tomorrow. People are not secure. This is all there. The economic situation is very bad. People have not gotten their salaries. So the situation is just very difficult.
That's Bishop Paul Yugushu, chairman of the South Sudan Church Leaders Mediation Initiative. He was speaking with viewers John Tanza from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The South Sudan Army was not immediately available for reaction. Ivory Coast voters have massively approved the new constitution the Electoral Commission announced on Tuesday, but the opposition, which had called for a boycott, contested the 42% official turnout, claiming it was much lower and that the poll is therefore not legitimate. Emily Yop reports for VOA from Abidjan.
After 2 days of tallying the votes, the president of the Electoral Commission, Yusuf Bakayoko, announced the national provisional result on Tuesday evening from the commission's headquarters in Abidjan.
Taux de participation 42.42%. Pour le oui, 2,480,000.
Bakayoko says the turnout was 42%, with 93% in favor. The new constitution, championed by Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara, intends to create a post of deputy president, set up a senate, and soften a controversial clause on nationality, which helped trigger years of civil war in a West African country. It also removed the former age limit of 75 for presidential candidates. The opposition contested the text, saying it is a move by the Ivorian president to reinforce the ruling party's grip on the institutions. An opposition coalition had called for a boycott of the vote, making the turnout the key element for the legitimacy of the poll. While the ballots were still being counted, some opposition leaders claimed the turnout was between 5 and 7%. But official results in some areas show a higher participation rate than during last year's presidential elections, which prompted them to assert the results were doctored to show a higher turnout.
C'est un tour fantaisiste. Tout le monde a constaté le désert électoral du 30 octobre en Côte d'Ivoire. Les Ivoiriens ne se sont pas déplacés.
Opposition member Bamba Moriferé says that the official 42% turnout is unrealistic. Everybody saw the electoral desert of October 30th. Ivorians didn't go to the polls. Mr. Ouattara gave an order to inflate the participation rate. We will not recognize this number, and we are calling for the people to resist this imposture, Moriferé said. The Electoral Commission is to send the result to the Constitutional Court for review and validation. Emily Yap for VOA News in Abidjan.
to this Wednesday, November 2nd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Sky 106.6 FM in Freetown, Sierra Leone, and KISS 104 FM in Bow, Sierra Leone, as well as VOA frequency station in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni on Tuesday ordered the closure of Makerere University, the country's largest and third oldest institution of higher learning. Lecturers there went on strike this week to demand payment of their incentive arrears. Students on Tuesday joined the strike to support their lecturers. The university administration says it cannot afford to pay the arrears because of a budget shortfall. In a directive issued Tuesday, President Museveni said he was closing Makerere with immediate effect in order to guarantee the safety of persons and property. Alex Atuhaire is news editor of the Uganda Daily Monitor newspaper. He says while the professor's strike has been mostly peaceful, there is concern that the addition of students might make it turn violent.
There has been a strike at the university by the lecturers and the professors. They had a disagreement with the management of the university over their allowances. Today, the students joined and went on strike too. This prompted a government response, and the president announced later in the evening that he was closing the university indefinitely. I think he wants the government and the management to deal with the issue of strikes at the university once and for all.
Alex, I saw the president's decree. President Museveni saying that he was closing the university to guarantee safety of persons and property. Has the strike been violent?
Yeah, normally these strikes, when they break out, especially with the students, they turn violent. Of course, the strike by the lecturers and the professors is not violent, but when the students join, then they get violent and they get involved in running battles with the police, which was happening the whole today. And the president thinks that that should be stopped.
You said that the professors and lecturers are on strike for allowances. Tell us, please, is it about salaries or just allowances?
They are areas of allowances. They have been demanding unpaid allowances for some years.
When you say allowances, what does this entail? Gasoline or what?
Ex-teaching allowances and then increase in pay. They are demanding for some areas of their increment in pay.
The lecturers indicate here that their arrears had accumulated to 27 billion shillings. How much is that?
Well, it is a hundred, the specific numbers, but that's the round figure. That was an increment that was agreed upon between the management and the lecturers in terms of pay, and then some of the allowances are what they call extra load. When they teach more hours, they get an allowance.
How long has this lecturer's strike been going on?
The lecturers did go on strike on Monday, and then the students joined into the strike on Tuesday.
The president has closed the universities. Will this interfere with the learning in terms of university schedule or calendar? Are there any exams coming up that might be interfered with the closure of the university?
This is particularly absolutely damaging for the students because they are coming to the closure of the semester and they are preparing for exams. That is time lost. So I think the losers here will be the students and the parents who will have to pay extra because of the interrupted learning period.
Do you know what the management of the university has told the lecturers? Is it that the university cannot afford to make payment of the allowances?
The university cannot afford because normally get a government subvention to supplement revenue that is collected from the private learning scheme, the students who pay privately. But over the years, the budget has always been overshot the needs of the university. The truth of the matter is that the university would do with more funding from government, and year in, year out, government has not budgeted for that kind of shortfall. So I think the university has reached at a point where they cannot then satisfy the lecturers' demands for increase or better pay. And then I don't think without a government support in terms of increased funding, the university is able to get out of this.
Alex, thank you very much again for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
You're welcome.
Alex Atu Haire is news editor of the Uganda Daily Monitor newspaper. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Simmering political tensions in the Democratic Republic of Congo were on display on Tuesday as the country's largest opposition party buried six people who were killed when the party's headquarters was attacked amid violent protests in September. William Klaus has the story from Kinshasa.
At the funeral service, hundreds of mourners made no secret of who they hold responsible for their loss. They sang that President Joseph Kabila is killing people in the Congo and must resign immediately. The day before, the six young men's bodies had been returned to the place where they died, the headquarters of their political party, the UDPS, the country's largest opposition party. Its compound in Kinshasa was set on fire in the early hours of September the 20th. The service took place in front of the burnt-out building. According to the United Nations, more than 50 people were killed during the unrest that erupted during an opposition march held on September the 19th. VOA spoke with Martin Fayulu, a prominent politician with the Rassemblement, an opposition coalition in which the UDPS plays a leading role.
Les militants de l'UDPS ont été tués par,
he says that the six opposition members were killed by Mr. Kabila's mob of soldiers as a reprisal for the demonstration. The attack shows Kabila's barbarism, Fayulu said, a barbarism everyone can see. He said that the best way to honor these six men's memories is to secure democracy.
La meilleure façon de commémorer, de rendre hommage.
Fayulu said that the opposition must accomplish the work that these activists started, and Kabila must step down on December the 19th when his term ends. A deal signed in Kinshasa last month and boycotted by much of the opposition, including the Rassemblement, allows Kabila to stay in office until delayed elections are held in April 2018. The government has rejected any link to the assault on the headquarters of the UDPS and has blamed unidentified criminal elements. But in a report released on October 21st, the United Nations Joint Human Rights Office said its investigation had found that the individuals who broke into the UDPS headquarters were wearing the uniforms of the Republican Guard, which is the Presidential Protection Force. The report says that the assailants proceeded to attack those inside the compound with machetes, beat those who could not escape, and then set the building on fire and threw into the flames those that they had detained. According to the UN's inquiry, the police then cordoned off the area, preventing the arrival of ambulances and the evacuation of the wounded. William Klaus for VOA News, Kinshasa.
The world's most popular messaging apps are failing to adequately protect users' security and privacy, according to Amnesty International. As Henry Richwell reports from London, Skype and Snapchat are among the big names criticized for failing to provide enough encryption.
Amnesty looked at 11 of the most popular messaging apps and found big variations in security. Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp came out on top with scores of 73 out of 100. Amnesty's Sharif El-Sayed Ali led the research.
For example, in WhatsApp, the application uses a very strong encryption. It does a very good job at telling people what kind of encryption it uses and how it protects people's information.
Conversely, Skype, which is owned by software giant Microsoft, and Snapchat performed poorly.
They do not use end-to-end encryption, which is essentially a kind of encryption that means that only the sender and the receiver are able to read the messages.
Snapchat disputes Amnesty's conclusions and says privacy and security are foundation values. Microsoft told VOA in a statement, Skype uses encryption and a range of other technical security measures, and we protect people's privacy through legal challenges, advocacy, and strong policies to notify customers when we receive government requests for their data. Amnesty's El Sayed Ali says it's not only personal privacy at stake.
Journalists all over the world who are trying to uncover corruption, trying to uncover abuses by government. There are activists who are resisting repression in their countries, and they are being actively sought out by their governments who are trying to find their information to disrupt their work and often to imprison them or persecute them.
At the bottom of Amnesty's rankings was the Chinese firm Tencent, which owns the messaging apps WeChat and QQ. It scored 0 out of 100. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Here's Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria, with this morning's roundup of Africa Sports.
Good morning, James. We begin with a wrap of Tuesday's UEFA Champions League played across various venues in Europe. Barcelona came to Manchester City and got a bitter taste of defeat as Manchester City was able to put 3 goals behind the Spaniards. 3-1 was the final scoreline. It leaves Group C with the Spaniards on top. City stay in second. Mönchengladbach and Celtic drew 1-1 with the Scots rooted at the bottom. In Group D, PSV entertained Bayern Munich, who beat the Dutch side 2-1. They are qualified alongside Atletico Madrid, who have maximum points from 4 games after beating Rostov with a last-minute goal. In Group A, PSG travelled to Switzerland and scored first against Basel, who equalised with barely 10 minutes on the clock before an injury-time volley gave the French side the point. Ludogorets had their hearts broken by a stunning Mesut Ozil strike as Arsenal squeaked past 3-2. Arsenal are qualified alongside PSG. Naples and Besiktas shared the points in a 1-1 draw in Group B, while Benfica beat Dynamo Kiev 1-0. The Ukrainians are out, but any two of the other three could still qualify in the tightest group. Meanwhile, Manchester City manager Pep Guardiola insists Nigerian-born striker Kelechi Iheanacho is a young player still in the process of his footballing education. Kelechi Iheanacho has impressed since breaking into the City team last season, weighing in with crucial goals. Ghanaian duo of Edwin Grima and Bernard Morrison suffered a crushing 6-1 defeat with Orlando Pirates against SuperSport United on Tuesday in the APSA Premiership. It was the joint heaviest defeat ever for the Buccaneers after losing by the same scoreline to Mamelodi Sundowns in the BP Top 8 in 1990. Elsewhere, Algeria have called up 18 foreign pros, including Leicester City stars Riyad Mahrez and Islam Selmani, as well as Sofiane Fengoli of West Ham for a World Cup qualifier. Newly appointed coach of Algeria national team, Jude Lakens, says his team will have a lot of work to do if they want to get a good result against Nigeria in Uyo. Algeria will play Group B leaders Nigeria on the 12th of November, a tie which could decide the leadership of the group before the next round of qualifiers, with group leaders Nigeria needing nothing but the win to be guaranteed top spot. Now to table tennis, where the International Table Tennis Federation is excited to announce the nominees for the 2016 male and female table tennis stars. Nigeria's Aron Akwadri has been nominated in the four-man list shortlisted for the award. Aron Akwadri, a former winner of the award, will be aiming for a record feat as the first player that will win the award for the second time. The Rio Olympics may have come and gone, but in Kenya, the Parliamentary Committee on Labour and Welfare that has been probing the mismanagement of Team Kenya at the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro will table its report in Parliament when the House reopens on November the 15th. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a very good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn has announced a cabinet reshuffle following months of often violent protests, which led the government to declare a state of emergency. That is it for this Wednesday, November 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth look at the electoral process and presidential elections in the United States. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Tuesday, November 8th, the American people will choose their new president. This historic campaign comes to an end and a new president is chosen. Our coverage will feature all of VOA's correspondents across the U.S. and around the world. Tune into our live comprehensive coverage between 00 and 0300 UTC GMT Wednesday morning, November 9th, right here on VOA.